Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Have you ever asked yourself, what is your superpower?
Everyone has a superpower. Most people just don't know what it is.
We're going to help you uncover it.
This podcast is all about helping people figure out what their truly unique superpower is.
Superpowers, what's yours?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Superpowers. We have an incredible guest here with us today. For those in the industry, he needs no introduction, but because 57% of our viewers are outside the industry, and that number's growing, I'd like to introduce our next guest, Mr. Terry Khawaja. Those of you who don't know Terry, born and raised Canadian, started his career as an investment bank. I think it was Citi and Credit Suisse, if I have that correct. Worked at a bunch of boutique investment banking firms and then started his own shop about 10 years ago. He is known for his comedy. He is known, for kind of being, greater than life. And people love him on stage. And I actually say I consider him more part of the kind of digital media, digital marketing, digital advertising data ecosystem more than I consider him a banker. Terry, thank you for joining us. This is great.
Great to be with you guys, Bill and Chris.
Welcome to the show. Terry, Bill, when you were doing that bio about all those great things, I thought you were talking about me and I was waiting for Terry to get his intro. But I echo Bill's fantastic introduction to someone that that is a friend, a mentor, and someone that is doing incredibly great work for the industry. And Terry, we've known each other personally, but so happy to have you officially on the Superpowers podcast show. Wish this was down at the studio together so I can, I'm a toucher. I like to, touch people while the show's going on. Those days are over. But Terry, let's start before we have a lot to cover. How are you, where are you? How are you and your family during this pandemic? Any insights in regards to what you guys are doing at a personal level before we get into you?
Well, thanks, Chris. We are here in New York City in the Upper East Side, otherwise known as the epicenter. In reality, we're perfectly fine. Everyone's in good health. We are sequestered in our apartment. We tend to go out once a day. I'll go for a run in the park or just a walk around the block just to sort of get outside and get some fresh air. But otherwise, we're pretty much on lockdown. And what I found is I'm able to sort of be relatively efficient, pretty busy with Zoom calls and good old-fashioned phone calls. And cranking out a lot of content and getting a lot of work done. So far, we have been lucky in the sense that we've not been that disrupted from a day-to-day standpoint.
Exactly. Other than the food. Knock on wood. And Terry, you have two sons. How are they doing? And how's homeschooling going?
Yeah, I've got a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old. And what's been amazing to me is how rapidly they adopted to their new reality of online schooling. Literally, here I was hovering around them saying, is everything okay? And, how are you managing in this transition? They're like, what, Dad? That was like yesterday. They're so elastic, right? This became their new normal almost immediately. And it's kind of like no big deal. Occasionally I get called in for IT support on something, but otherwise they're kind of good to go, which is incredible.
I think it's safe to say we're all IT support these days.
I just tweeted this the other day, which is the ability to unplug and restart from an IT perspective takes you a very, very long way. Our boys are similar in age, Terry, and I want to echo that sentiment. I think you and I shared comments on this about a week ago, about 3 weeks ago or 3.5 weeks ago, terrified with the idea of them being home for all the same kind of reasons of this going into this unknown, but they are extremely resilient and yeah. I think they actually enjoy it more. And you learn how to be a good PE teacher and how to hunker down, but I think number one, once the family, your family and your kids are good, everything else can fall into line.
Yeah, I can say is thank God for the telcos and their 5.9 reliability. I mean, Verizon AT&T, I mean, without broadband and our phones, we'd be in a very different experience right now.
Hey, Terry, just quick one. Either say up, down, or same. Exercise.
Up.
Drinking.
Up.
Sex.
Same.
All right, that's good. Food.
Oh, up. I finally get to find out. We have a person who cooks for us and takes care of the kids, and the food is so good, and I've been missing out this whole time on these amazing lunches. I'm like, this is like gourmet every day. It's incredible. And my wife is like, that's every day. You're at work. I'm like, okay, now I get it. I might, you know.
Nice.
Going forward, I may do work from home a little bit more often.
Okay, and then last one, meetings.
Same.
Yeah, yeah. I got to tell you, I feel the same way, other than the sex part. Mine is up. you know, it's amazing that I kind of feel like I'm more efficient now than I've ever been. You know, kind of like you realize how inefficient travel is, you know, just banging out meetings all day, every day. And the fact that we can all see each other and you can get connected and video conference is just damn efficient. I kind of feel like business may never be the same again.
Well, I'm most certainly on a variety of fronts. When we get back to normal, can't be soon enough, but yep. We have to do it the right way. I think there'll be a number of things that will be different.
Yeah.
Terry, to piggyback on Bill's list, which I think is great, any new hobbies or things that you've picked up that's been in kind of on hold because you haven't had the time? Or anything fun, a new board game, a book, or any little kind of anything creatively that you've started to do in the last 3 or 4 weeks?
You know, there's a sort of like a general philosophy that I have with respect to the impact of this coronavirus. And that is that, yes, I suppose it's breeding some new habits, but for the most part, what it's doing, what I found at least, is it's accelerating what you were already doing before. It's just accelerating that. So if there was like the industry consolidation, it's accelerating that. You know, and in my life, you know, I like to crank out these you know, creative projects, both work product and comedic product when I have the time. And what I found is in the last 2 weeks, I've just been hyper efficient at being able to crank out more. So I'm not sure, Chris, there are different habits. It's just that I'm able to sort of do more of the same. So it's kind of like steroids.
Yeah.
All right. Steroids.
So obviously this is the Superpowers podcast. We try to uncover everyone's unique superpower. What we like to do is start from the very beginning. We want to know what a young little Terry sitting somewhere in Canada was like. Brothers, sisters, what your parents did. Give us the young Terry.
The young Terry. All right. So I'm 57. I mean, born in late 1962 in Quebec, in a very, very small remote town where my dad was stationed at a paper mill. And I grew up in Quebec in a variety of provinces on the eastern coast of Canada and a little bit in Massachusetts. Go Boston, Chris. Essentially, you know, I was the middle child, an older brother, younger sister, all relatively.
By the way, you're our third podcast this week. All middle children, all incredibly successful.
Well, and I had the middle child syndrome, which is, you know, the older brother got spoiled because he was the first. My parents were like experimenting on parenting with him. And then the younger sister was the princess. So she got away with anything. And I kind of got stuck in the middle. But in reality, I had a fun childhood. I was always the jokester, prankster. I know, what a shock. You know, I kind of was always sort of striving for attention and trying to do things that got a light out of people. And when I was able to do that, when I cued into what worked, I was like, huh, interesting. I'll do more of that.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of fun in childhood. Interestingly, I became the family photographer I was pretty good at it. And this is back in the Polaroid days, of course. And yet one of the consequences of that is there are virtually no pictures of me as a child. I mean, I got a handful of them. That's it. Everyone else, because I was the one on the other side of the camera most of the time.
And then as a middle child, you get to complain about no pictures, you know, be like, oh, there's no pictures of me.
Absolutely.
Except the ones that we dug up, Terry. Except the ones that we put our investigators on, which will be on the interwebs later. We had one of our first guests in season one, Terry, was the foodie magician, Josh Beckerman. In case you watched that episode, blew Bill's mind at the studio. And while that is his true life profession, not M&A and media and technology. What were there some things at an early age, whether it was magic or laughs, like what specifically was it that you sort of identified with where it was this ability to get attention? What were the tools that you were doing? What was that moment? And like, if we did have your brother, was it brother, sister? Sorry.
Yeah, brother and a sister. Yeah.
If we had them on, what would they say about you? And honestly, and F-bombs are okay.
Yeah. Sure. I'll go in reverse order. Attention hog probably is what they would say. Although I was always like, it's one thing if you like commanding attention, but the other thing is you got to deliver the goods. Like if you can be funny and quippy, then, you know, I kind of, you got to earn the microphone, so to speak. Well, we grew up sort of lower middle class. I mean, the teeny little 1100 square foot bungalow that I grew up in Toronto, once we settled down, where the, you know, 9.5 by 9.5 foot room that I shared with my brother in bunk beds, I never thought anything of it. I just thought that was sort of normal. I look back on that now and, you know, now I find myself telling my kids, look, in when I was your age, it sort of, that doesn't work. But there was a few moments, Chris, that were sort of teachable moments that are sort of vignettes of my life where I sort of learn certain things. At the age of 6, I'm at my aunt's wedding in Prince Edward Island. And as a joke, I dress up like a gangster. I have this fake gun. And I decide to go upstairs and stand outside the loo, outside the bathroom. And every time someone came out of the bathroom, I'd say, stick them up. And they would take out the coins, back when people used coins in their pocket, and held them out. And the first guy slapped his hand. All the coins went all over the floor. And he was like, yeah, you get him, kid. And he walked downstairs and I picked up all these coins. And I did the same thing to the next guy and the next guy and the next guy. It was a wedding, so there was a lot of people. And at the end of the night, I had $6.77, which to a six-year-old in 1968, let me tell you something, it was all the money in the world.
A lot of money.
And so what I learned from that episode was crime pays. Seriously. that if you can be creative, if you can do so, a good narrative can earn you something. So that was a good lesson. Years later, I'm in Toronto and I bought a paper route. I said bought a paper route. I took over a paper route because at the age of 9, a neighbor came to me and he said, hey, I am moving on Friday. This is now a Tuesday. And do you want to buy my paper route? It's a really cool thing. And I'm like, and I kind of drag my feet Wednesday, Thursday, the guy's coming after me. Are you sure? Can I convince you to buy the paper? Well, by Friday, of course, he has to just hand me the keys to it. So I learned something there. And I actually had that for 5 years. And by the end of it, I had 4 people actually delivering the newspapers. We expanded. And I bought other franchises.
Did you ever have to yell, I want my $2? Did that ever come out of your mouth?
I learned about operating leverage. I learned about capital cost, like just invaluable stuff.
Yeah.
Now, at a cost though, right? I mean, every day after school from age 9 to 14, I for an hour and a half I was delivering the newspapers or supervising people who were delivering the newspapers.
The worst was collect. Right? Collect. Yeah. Because, you know, there were no credit. Like, people didn't pay by credit cards. You literally knocked on doors and all you said was collect, which meant you had to pay for the newspapers. Collect was hard.
Well, and then those are another set of skills you got to learn, right? Where, you know, maybe a good, you know, remember that 6-year-old lesson about the good narrative and invoking your creative skills or comedic skills. that's helpful too in terms of getting people to pay. So,
yeah. Now, Terry, were you when you were doing this, were you more focused on sort of the idea of the hustle and the small business? Were you also finding time for sports? And then segue that into, we asked about your siblings. Also, Bill and I always love to understand a little bit about parents and what you learned and observed from your mom and dad.
And what they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So, dad was an engineer who became a manager, a very, very smart guy. So he graduated top of his class, went to Harvard Business School. He was a Baker Scholar. So he was like a really smart guy.
So that didn't come to you?
No, not at all.
You're funny.
So he was book smart. Mom was street smart.
Yeah.
And I like to say I captured just enough of the two of them for that combination. But what very importantly, my dad didn't have the best career. He sort of it really sort of ended on a whimper. And he didn't. What I learned was he didn't manage his career. Like, in other words, he was good at his job, but he didn't prioritize himself. That taught me tons in terms of making sure that I was, you know, looking out for you know who. As I went through an added value in my career in other ways, because it turns out it's not good enough to just be good at your day job. You also have to make sure that others don't sort of run roughshod over you.
You know, I had a conversation with my daughter recently about kind of quote unquote playing the game. And told her, I was like, you're not, you got to learn how to play the game. It's so important, because being great isn't enough. You gotta network, you gotta play the game, you gotta understand connections, and you gotta speak up, and you gotta have a plan.
You know? Gotta speak up. And the other thing is, you know, be opportunistic, like seize the moment. I'm back on my paper road, right? I'm delivering papers. I'm now 14, and I read in so the one thing that was a unforeseen advantage of delivering the newspapers was I read them. So I read the newspaper like every day from age 9 to 14. And that's not usual, I don't think, or at least not wasn't in the 1970s. And I read on page like B17 or whatever, there was an official notice that Brewers Retail, the sort of the government regulated co-op of beer stores in Canada, everyone gets their beer in one place, and we drink a lot of beer in Canada. So they announced that starting in 2 weeks, they would change the refund amount from 5 cents a bottle to 10 cents a bottle. And it's religion, but like more so than church. Canadians every Saturday morning bring their empties of their cases of beer back to Brewers Retail. They get their cash, and then they buy the next week's batch. And so I'm like, I looked at this, I read it, and I reread it, and I said, wait a second, are they pre-announcing the doubling of price of a commodity publicly? Really? And so, you know, I called up my friend Dino, and I said, does your dad, does he use his painting truck on the weekends? Answer, no. I'm like, great. Can he drive us somewhere this Saturday? And he goes, sure. What do you got? What's up? So I take my, you know, changer. We take the van, we park it in front of Brewers Retail at 9:55, 5 minutes before it opens, open up the back doors, and we're buying empties from everybody for 5 cents, and we're doing it quickly. We notice we're missing some people, so I go into the Brewers Retail, and I'm like, hey, we're a couple kids. We're buying empties from people out there. If you want to do less work and you want to help the kids, just direct them out there. So they did. They put up a sign saying, go, the kids will take care of you. And so we filled up the van 4 times over 2 Saturdays, and then just brought them back the next weekend with our commodity doubled in price. And we start bringing them in the front door, and they're like, whoa, 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 wait a second. What you got? I said, 4 vans full. They're like, okay. Bring it around the back to the loading dock, and we unload it, and we made $4,000.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't.
Yes, $4,000.
How old were you?
I was 14.
That's awesome.
So this is 1977. I can't even drive. I got $4,000. So we split it 2,000, 2,000. And, you know, here we were. Mr. Dell'Orletta gave us a drive. So, like, I'm handing him, like, here's
his cut.
Wait a minute. He goes, get out of here.
By the way, By the way, there was a Seinfeld episode about this when Kramer figured out it was 10 cents in Wisconsin.
I didn't have to drive across the country. When I saw that episode, I just killed myself laughing.
Yeah, it's Newman.
And I had to borrow the capital from my dad, right? This required capital in order to, need money to make money. I didn't have any money.
So what was your dad's cut? What was your dad's cut?
Well, no, I cut him in. I gave him a decent return. In fact, he goes, no, I don't deserve all of this. And I said, yes, you do. And so I parlayed that into another sort of opportunity. I was buying cars. I would buy a car for a summer, and then I would clean it up. I'd detail it myself, and then sell it at the end. And I remember my dad was a very sort of risk averse guy, yep. And I was sort of, calculated risks were a good thing. And when my brother's girlfriend's father had a car coming off lease, and it was a beautiful 1976 Monte Carlo SE in midnight blue with a white Landau roof. I'm talking Pimpmobile.
Wow. This thing was
unbelievable. And he said, you can buy it for $1,200. And I'm like, Dad, I need capital. And he goes, I don't know about this. And I'm like, yeah. Give me the capital. So he gives me the capital.
He's the only 14-year-old going, Dad, I need the capital.
I was 16 at this point because I had to drive. Right? So I drove it all summer, a 16-year-old driving that car, let me tell you something. That was like pretty freaking awesome. And then I detailed it, I sold it, and I made like a couple grand profit, and I gave it to, I gave him a cut of it, and he was like, this is unbelievable. And I said, that's capital. That's what capital can
do. You're basically like the Canadian version of Alex P. Keaton.
So when Alex P. Keaton came out, I was like, oh my God. Everyone in my family was like, did they make a TV show about you? Yeah, I was... You know how they say if you're not like a socialist at age 20, you have no heart, not a liberal at age 30, you have no soul, and not a capitalist at age 40, you have no brains or money. I kind of went in the opposite direction. I was slightly right of Genghis Khan at 18. So, and then I got some perspective.
I'm watching, I'm deep into Narcos Mexico right now. And there's, as you talked about, sort of doling out cash to all these, to all your team here that helped you make your money. It reminds me of that flow. Terry, what was it like? What was your perception of the United States at that age? What was it like living in Canada at that age? But more, well, I'm just curious, like how did you perceive the world looking across the border?
Good question. So obviously, we're growing up, we get the Canadian news and we get all the American news, right? In Toronto, we would get the ABC, NBC, and CBS affiliates from Buffalo. So, American TV and American TV shows in Hollywood is exactly the same in Canada. It's just that we had Canadian news as well. I was a big admirer of America growing up. In fact, again, talk about bizarre politics. My two favorite presidents of all time are Barack Obama and Ronald Reagan. Figure that one out, right?
By the way, you can pay therapists to help you figure that out. We're the therapist. There you go.
That's what the show is, Bill.
I looked at the United States, with sort of realistic eyes. We used to joke in history class in Canada, we would, our history professor would literally show us a book, a history book from the United States and read from it. We'd all like get a good laugh because according to the history books, by the way, much of them are corrected now, but they had America winning the War of 1812 and winning, in Vietnam. We're like, that's funny.
Oh, God.
Yeah, well, I think, in general,
I was positive about the U.S.
So you go to college where? In Canada or U.S.?
I did all of my education in a country with socialized education. So I went.
I forgot. You were Alex P. Keaton. So you went where the college was free.
You bet, or close to free. But put it this way: I went to undergrad. I studied economics and statistics at the University of Western Ontario, and then I studied law school at Osgoode Hall Law School and business school at the Schulman School of Business. from the beginning. So it was a lot of
stuff. By the way, are you a lawyer? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I did the JD MBA combined degree, 5 years of schooling and 4. But so when I started university, it was $1,200 a year tuition. And when I finished, it was like 2,500. It was nothing, absolutely nothing. And by the end, I was like a teacher aide making 20 grand a year. So I actually made money on my education.
And Terry, that on top of outside of education, you have your medical covered as well, right? In Canada. Yeah.
Yeah.
You and I have, I think we've talked about
this. Like every other Western nation on this planet, but for this one. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So your Canada sounds great. It's not as great as Finland, which you always you tease me about. Still the happiest place on earth and leading with education and health. But Canada is that same bucket, Terry.
I don't know if you saw it, but happy, any one of these, whether it's happiest places or best quality of life, there's Finland and Canada are both in the top 10. Yeah. Finland's usually in the top 5.
Which, by the way,
in the top 10, but hey.
Which, by the way, is crazy because if you visit Finland outside of the summer, it is probably the most depressing place you could go with 2 hours of daylight and a high level of alcoholism. But hey,
they're
aside,
good at filling out the surveys, I guess.
When education and health is something that you, for the average family, is not a burden. That's a freedom.
Yeah.
So Terry, you do a whole bunch of schooling. When do you get to the U.S.? Was it your first job or?
I had summer jobs. And for 9 years, I worked at a golf course. So I was Carl Spackler from Caddyshack for 9 years at the same golf club with, you know, all these, you know, wealthy members. And I was like the worker guy. That was kind of an interesting dynamic. That was like a sociology class in and of itself. But yeah, my first real job. So I went straight through and it was 26 years old when I finally finished school, kind of late start on life. And my first job. So here I am in, you know, law and business school in the 80s, in the mid 80s, when everything is, the shit's hitting the fan in terms of M&A, hostile takeovers, and there's all this dynamism. And I was like, oh, yeah, I suppose I could do what every other Canadian does and go to work on Bay Street. It's the Canadian version of Wall Street in Toronto. But the action is in New York. I was basically completely disinterested in anything but going to work on Wall Street. And, you know, by hook or by crook, because the, you know, Salomon Brothers, none of the major Wall Street bulge bracket firms even recruited at our school. Basically forced my way down to New York, forced my way into interviews, and basically hired myself at Salomon Brothers in 1989. And just lived
the dream. So 1989, that's post, like Reagan was eating his jelly beans.
Post-87 crash.
And the 87-88 crash. So it was not a great time in 89.
No, in fact, 1990, there was a real estate crash, and they fired, 6 months into the job, they fired one third of the class ahead of me. So that taught me that, okay, you're on, pal. It's like performance time, and they're going to cull like a big proportion of your class. So, yes, this will be an incredible career if you can keep your job. And, talk about lighting a fire and causing all kinds of stress and lots of other things, but it was trial by fire.
So Terry, we know you as the guy who, you know, goes deep for an investment banker, really, really knows the industry, but also your parody videos and comedy. What were you like as kind of like a junior associate, like a, you know, first, second, fourth year Wall Street kid?
Yep. Well, I was lucky in that purge of 1990 I mentioned. They got rid of the big chunk of the class ahead of me. And of course, in a series of purges, basically there was like no one ahead of my class for like 3 or 4 years. So it was trial by fire. I kind of got elevated to running deals as early as like 1991. So that was beneficial. And, it was around that time where I started doing comedy. In fact, I was doing comedy my first year there. it made it so that it was helpful. I think it's sort of an effective tool to sort of grease the skids in terms of, you know, getting deals done, boardroom humor. I have a set of rules. I did a webinar on comedy and business where I talk about five rules and, you know, be good at your day job, make sure you're funny and pick your spots and a bunch of stuff that I think what I've learned over, you know, doing comedy for many decades now. But one interesting thing I did was we had this annual outing and the whole investment bank would get together and play golf or tennis at some fancy club up in Westchester, up near where, you know, Chris lives, in the fancy places, right? And so after the golf, you know, everyone would shower up and then come in before the dinner but before the dinner, there would be this comedy segment we would do, basically do a weekend update style format where I would take down the most powerful people at the firm. So think Ricky Gervais.
You were doing a roast.
I was doing a roast in the form of this sort of news thing. And, you know, I did this for 6 or 7 years and it became the highlight of the outing. People would come up just for that. And it became this was not kid glove sort of middle of the road pablum stuff. This was eviscerating, brutal takedowns of the senior most powerful people and senior people at the firm. And it was funny because it was true. Like, we really sort of had that community of interest. And Solomon Brothers had this sort of very sharp elbowed culture. So no other comedy would even work at Solomon. You actually had to come at someone with an axe and take them down. And it became such that the senior most powerful people wanted to ensure that I was going to pick on them, because if I didn't, then maybe they didn't.
They're a little soft.
So people wore like a badge of honor, and it elevated me to a level on as a peer to these partners, because I was the one able, I was the court jester able to take them down.
That's like the perfect scenario when you get to actually use your skills and passion and not get ridiculed for it and actually be praised for it.
Well, I call it my version of Maslow's self-actualization, right? I am going to hit the pinnacle on that pyramid if I can do my day job and benefit my day job career by doing what I love to do, which is the comedy stuff. So if I can somehow do the double upper, then that's it. I'm self-actualizing. It's like Terry out.
Hey Terry, have you ever actually done stand-up comedy?
Yes.
You have?
Yes. And I've done it in a pure, I did it to test material. So I did it pure, which is to say I didn't pre-announce I was going to, you know, amateur mic night at Caroline's or wherever and have all my friends pile in and support me. I thought that's bullshit. That could be a false positive. I would go unannounced to an open mic night, often after working till like midnight at the office on deals. And then I'd have a set, right, that I'd prepare. And I would go usually on the Upper West Side to a comedy shop. And I just rattled this off. The funny thing was they were all drunk at that point. The audience is drunk. And I would try out materials and look, varying degrees, but mostly pretty damn good. The comedy people wanted me to come back. I was, of course, you know, busy as an investment banker. So it was just a hobby thing.
Hey, Terry, since 1989, have you lived in New York City since 1989 then?
Correct. I've been here almost 30 years.
Wow. You're more of a New Yorker than almost anyone now.
Yeah, feels like it sometimes.
So you were at Solomon, now City. You did switch banks at one point, right?
Yeah. In fact, I left Wall Street to in a perfect timing, March of 2000, right at the S&P peak.
Yeah.
And joined a company, a startup. That had already had $175 million of private funding back when you needed a lot of money. It was a video conferencing business of all things. And back then you needed your own blade servers. There was no such thing as the cloud. So we raised a ton of money from everybody and their sister, Microsoft, Panasonic, SoftBank, you name it. I joined as the CFO, the last amendment to the red before the perspectives went final, and we went public. And of course, we all know what happened in 2000. We still made it out. We were in fact pricing the deal on the trading floor at Salomon Brothers in July of 2000, we're pricing the deal after having come back from the European version of the roadshow on the Air France, what do they call that supersonic jet?
Concorde.
A Concorde, right. When the Concorde blew up.
No.
We were watching it blow up. We were on that same exact flight a week prior. So we got the company out. Long story short, lost our currency when the market went down. Made every number as a public company CFO, but we ended up selling the business. I came back to the street, worked at Credit Suisse for a year until they bought me out of my ridiculous contract. And then I went off and did other things.
So by the way, before we get off of Salomon, I believe you were at least one of the bankers on the richest deal in M&A history, correct?
Correct. In fact, I was the lead M&A banker, the one with the signature on the engagement letter for AOL Time Warner. Now, this is a deal. This is a very infamous deal that has been seen as the worst deal of all time, and I think that is a function of depending on which side. So it's M&A is largely a zero sum game. So when people say it was the most disastrous deal, and there's a litany of unfortunate souls whose 401ks were eviscerated because they worked for Time Warner. Think about it. My client, AOL, was able to conduct what, in hindsight, was the greatest legal but unwarranted transfer of wealth ever in the history of man. $55 billion transferred from Time Warner shareholders to AOL shareholders for no particular logical reason, other than the fact that we convinced them to agree to the deal. Yes, it was a disaster. It was probably a deal that was 20 years ahead of its time. But think about it, combining media and internet delivery, it seems like a no-brainer today. Too early. And like I said, my client's still happy today. Success has 1,000 fathers, and yet, I still have the engagement letter with my signature on it framed in my office on the wall, because at $60 million, that was my fee for that deal. That was at the time, the highest fee ever received in an M&A deal for the biggest M&A deal ever announced. Again, all of the time, it's been surpassed at this point, but it was a hell of a experience.
So most of the bankers, most of the investment bankers I know, charge points on a deal. How does one negotiate the fees on a $55 billion acquisition? Yeah,
$183 billion acquisition was that the actual value of the deal. Yeah, that was an interesting one. There was no precedent, obviously, for a deal of that size. And the chairman of the investment bank basically relegated me to sort of prepare that conversation with the CFO of AOL. And I had my analysis prepared. He said to me, are you ready? You ready for the conversation? I said, I'm ready for when they're ready. In other words, we were heads down working that deal. Yep. There was 4 days we didn't sleep. Where over the weekend leading up to January 10th, 2000, we were doing all the due diligence and financial work and fairness opinion and board presentations and all of that, literally 4 days with no sleep. And yet, I was prepared for that conversation when and if it needed to happen. And of course, my boss said, look, I have to be there for that negotiation. Do not do that on your own. I said, oh, okay, no problem. I'll find you. And sure enough, on the Saturday night, we're at a law firm and we're working late. And then the CFO grabs me by the arm and he says, I need you for 5 minutes. So he pulls me out into the hallway and he goes, okay, I need to talk to you about the fee. And I'm like, oh, okay. And boom, I had my full, I had 2 pages.
Yeah.
2 pages of support for what was going to be the biggest ask of an M&A fee in the history of the world, $60 million. And I'm like, great, hang on a second, let me just get Eduardo. And I'm looking in the room, he's gone. He's, I can't find him. And he goes, gotta go. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. And he goes, what's your proposal? I know you have one. And I said, yeah, so here's the thing. I could justify 80 based on these numbers, boom, 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 and these deals. I'm asking for 60. I think it's the right number. It's fair, bada bing, bada boom. And he's like, looks it over. He's like, okay, fine. And I said, okay, well then here you go. I write in 60, my handwriting. And I'm like, my hand shaking probably. I'm like, initial here, initial and sign. He goes, gotta go. I said, no, hang up. Second copy, sign this one.
Second copy, sir.
He signs it. And he goes, look, there's bigger issues going on in back in that room. I got to get back in there. He goes in the room. I'm standing there sort of dumbfounded, holding on to this engagement letter.
Incredible.
And at that moment, Eduardo comes out of the men's room, zipping up. Like, he looks over at me and he goes, what? And he goes, it's done. He said, what do you mean it's done? He goes, I told you. I said, I looked for you. He goes, okay, what'd you get? I said, I got the ask. And he goes, really? He goes, how'd you do it? I said, kind of just like that. He goes, really? Holy shit. He goes, you can negotiate every engagement letter from now on. He goes, it was unbelievable. So we were just going like, holy crap.
By the way, I have to apologize for the viewers. Hopefully this is maybe you're watching it on a podcast. I haven't gotten a haircut in like 2.5 months. And every day I tried to figure out like what to do with my hair. It's not good.
We're just going back to the
age. Your hair looks great, man. You just need some good wax.
Listen to the master.
So Terry, yeah. you crossed the border. We never even had a chance to talk about how much I love Canadian beer. Hopefully there's time for that. You and I met, we gotta jump forward. So during the GCA days, if I recall, it was around 2007, 2008 zone. Yep. I think around the time you and I met, which was the year I started App Savvy. And I really wanted to kind of talk about there was, you know, your time there, sure, but also kind of the beginning of the Luma, the LumaScape, the Luma chart, which I know a lot of people, I'm sure there's a lot of people that may or may not have the connection as it relates to you or your firm. But can we talk a little bit about the development and how that came to origin?
Let me also just jump in here. I mean, it's interesting because Terry and I over the last 15 years each have like three career moves, each which coincided with each other. You know, when we were both at a smaller, he was at a smaller boutique investment firm, and I was at a boutique ad tech firm. And I left to go to Mediabank. He left to go to GCA. Then I was merging with. Oh no! So. No, that's when I sold. Then I went to Right Media. We sold to Yahoo. You went to GCA. Then I was going to Mediabank, which eventually became Mediaocean, as you were thinking about starting Luma. So, for those of you, listening, people may think the advertising landscape is kind of simple, but the supply chain is actually pretty complex and certainly very fragmented. Terry is the author of what he calls the LumaScapes, which is the landscape of the various ecosystems. Yeah, how did you come up with the idea? Because it was brilliant. And for those of you who don't know, the LumaScape, is basically hundreds and hundreds of logos broken into categories for the supply chain for various parts of the digital ecosystem, and it ends up in almost every single pitch deck, in all these board decks, in M&A transactions. I mean, it was brilliant. It's been viewed, I think, in more countries than have coronavirus. I'm very curious as to how you came up with the idea to do it.
So I'm a graphical person, right? And it turns out there's science behind this, right? People, your brain can process graphics 62 times faster than text. And you will retain that image. You store it in a different part of the brain. So text gets stored up here, graphics back here. And the storage is much more visceral and longer lasting. And so as a graphical person, I discovered graphics were far better presentation tool. Recall back in the day, you know, you would have people in particular of my ilk, right, bankers, that have bullet points and numbers, and it was just horrific presentations. I always had pictures, and I would speak the words, and the pictures were simply supporting graphics. And so I wasn't the first person to map an industry ecosystem, but I was amongst the earliest to do it in graphical form by taking the logos of companies, because the previously mentioned better processing of graphics. And second is, I figured it'd play to the ego. See, this is marketing for all these companies. They get to see their graphic, you know, on a page as opposed to just their name listed. So it was actually like any sort of great thing that turns out to have significant impact. Started off completely different, right? I put together a page to try and comprehend these companies. The very first landscape chart was 175 logos. Booked into buckets, where I was just trying to use it as an internal tool to understand what the hell was going on with this complex and dynamic and fragmented ecosystem. So I put it together. I spent more time on it. The more people I shared it with, and Bill, you were amongst the earliest people that I shared those concepts with, and got lots of feedback from people going, oh, actually, no, they don't quite do that. They do this. And so I got expert crowdsourcing was something I learned. And we put this thing together, and it just took on a life of its own. I presented it at a conference in 2010, and you know, the rest, as they say, is history. The funny thing is, you know, the original name was the Display Advertising Technology Landscape, when I left GCA, which was a perfectly good firm with good people, but I found, you know, there was a much bigger opportunity that I could do on my own. Founded Luma in September of 2010. So we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary. And then fast forward to June of 2011, I then come out with three more Lumascapes: the video advertising technology landscape, the mobile one, and the social one. And I was fortunate enough to have the Wall Street Journal was going to print these. And they had this story, and I'd sent them in the graphics and everything. And I'm sitting there at like 7:30 going, wait, you know, the Display Advertising Technology Landscape, that's a mouthful. Why don't I shorten that landscape, Lumascape? I already called my company Luma. I was trying to get brand recognition, build a global brand with no money. Hard to do, but I'm a big believer in content marketing. So what do? I call up the journal. I'm like, you can't print. I said, I got new graphics. They're like, deadline is 8:00. Get them to us in the next 12 minutes. And so I did. I just redid them as Lumascape. They printed them in the Wall Street Journal in June 11th, 2011. And the rest, as they say, is history. Today, they've been viewed over 12.5 million times from over 200 countries. There are now 22 Lumascapes mapping over 5,000 independent companies. I mean, it's just blossomed into a thing.
Terry, one of the things that I think is actually maybe an untold story, or at least something that I observe in regards to Luma, is indirectly you started off to solve a complex problem, just making sense of a landscape, which you realize other people appreciated. You figured out distribution. Clearly, you're good at graphics, so there's a nice combination in your favor. But what I think is really interesting is, you know, creating the Luma and creating these charts necessarily isn't a way to monetize. But what I love about it is that it's indirectly. I love businesses that understand that what they put out from a content or marketing perspective, indirectly or directly, can feed where you actually can monetize and where you can make money, where you can get transactions. And that's the part that I actually appreciate the most, which is you don't sell the Luma chart, you give it away for free. And then all those dots connect to, oh, this guy's an investment banker. Oh, he works in New York. Oh, so that's the part that I don't know if a lot of people think or appreciate, or maybe it's super obvious, but that's the part that I think is
interesting. Actually, it's interesting you say that. I think there's a big chunk, maybe a third of the people that know us for the Lumascape have no idea that we actually operate an investment bank that does mergers and acquisitions.
You heard it here first, folks, on the Superpowers Podcast.
What's interesting about the funnel that we've created, right? If you think of it, we're at the bottom of the funnel, and we're very, by definition, transactional in the sense that I only get paid on success, only when a deal closes. If a deal closes, that's at the very bottom. And yet we recognize that, you know, like all marketing, it's a funnel. And so think of the Lumiscapes at the top of our funnel, free and ubiquitous, and thankfully, you know, utilized everywhere to get the name brand recognition out, ergo the sort of the Kleenex or Coke sort of brand name association. But then, you know, we're also producing content. We do, you know, quarterly reports. We're always publishing decks on all kinds of different topics, because that's sort of like the next level down of engagement, where we want to put that content out. We want it to be free. I remember my partners at GCA, when I started publishing these presentations I made, they said, wait a second, why are you giving that away? That's a valuable IP. And yeah, my first reaction was, well, valuable IP, that's good to know. I'll remember that at comp time. But the reality is, you know, if I presented that in person, I could do that to 200 people, 300 maybe a year. This way I was getting out to audiences of 10,000 at the time, and now it's in the millions. So they just didn't understand this concept of this funnel. We do that, we present at conferences, that we get invited in by, you know, YouTube and Facebook and Oracle and you name it, Procter & Gamble, to come in and talk to their leadership teams. That builds relationship, and then ultimately it feeds the beast, right? I mean, you get to do more deals because you've created that full funnel. And
it's almost like a flywheel, Terry. You almost developed or built a full stack or flywheel in the sense of how a technology company thinks about building their product. M&A has always been very siloed. You've almost thought about it holistically, that here's the stack or the flywheel. Absolutely. As it relates to all things M&A.
Absolutely. Hey, Terry, talking about brand, talk about the name Luma. Some have said they think it's the first two letters of your two sons' names. Some think it's Luma stands for something else. Like, what is it?
So here I was in July of 2010. I've now made my exit from GCA, and I've got to launch my own firm. And that means I need a brand name, right? I need a name of my firm, and I wasn't going to be Kawaja and Associates. That's I'm a big believer in operating leverage. See the Piper Road experience at age 9. So I knew that I wasn't going to name it after my last name. That's a huge mistake. And so I said, okay, you know, Nike, Puma, I mean, whatever. There's lots of brand. The shorter the name, the better. Luma is the definition of a luma is the amount of brightness in a video pixel. So brightness, brilliance, ideas, that all seemed to make sense. It also happens to be an acronym mashup for my two sons, Lucas and Matthias. So yeah, it's kind of like clever, kind of cute. And boy, has that worked. I mean, it's worked.
And those names, just because we have to kind of touch on it, Terry, I want to talk about your we talked about your boys. That doesn't sound like a Peter and Tom kind of name. They may sound like they come from a South American.
It also doesn't sound Canadian.
Yeah. No, so it's not really Canadian. Well, I had a couple of constraints. My wife is from Brazil, and so it had to be a name that couldn't be shortened. And that was pronounceable the same in English and Portuguese. So with those two constraints, we ended up with Lucas and Matthias.
Nice.
Brilliant. So, Terry, a couple more things as we kind of get to the end of the show here.
I thought this was a 24-hour marathon.
Yeah, no, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon.
Sorry, it's a state for our viewers right now. I think you know, as relates to Luma and the Lumascape and kind of your background, some fascinating and interesting insights. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, macro, how your firm and your team, great team, by the way, sees the current world and current position that we're in as relates to what you guys do day in and day out? I think it'd be it's something we obviously have to ask given this climate. I'm sure there's a lot of curiosity on that topic.
Well, I appreciate your compliment. I absolutely do have the most incredible team. You know, we started small and we stayed small. So, you know, the Luma team in total is, you know, when people ask me about the size of Luma, I ask them, well, do you know Goldman Sachs? They're like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, we're a little smaller. but we punch way above our weight. And by sticking with just A-listers, I am fortunate and lucky to have the incredible cadre of partners and employees that we do have at Luma. So thank you for that. Look, I think this is a obviously it's a challenging time, but look, we've had challenges before, and we'll have them again. So this is a particularly an unprecedented one, to use a phrase that seems to be ubiquitous these days. No. It is severe, and there will be impacts. M&A tends to, so I'll go back to a comment I mentioned earlier, which is to say, it seems like this coronavirus crisis situation has acted as an accelerant to what was otherwise happening anyways. And in this ecosystem, as I'm actually going to be talking about in my webinar, this will probably come out afterwards, but my webinar on the state of industry consolidation I'm doing on April the 8th, we're going to talk about how every industry goes through an arc of new company formation, maturity, and then rationalization and consolidation. Totally natural. Every industry goes through it. Yeah. In the 1980s, there was like dozens and dozens of ERP software companies. Today, there are six. And yeah. So, it usually takes about 20 years, goes through this arc. The same exact thing will apply here to AdTech and MarTech. It's just that it's a little bit different in the sense that it's on steroids. Instead of dozens of companies, there are thousands of companies. That is a function of the fact that most of these businesses are virtual, right? There's no physical goods because of cloud infrastructure and because of the availability of venture capital. So you put all those together and you get this perfect storm where we created an industry, and by the way, a large industry and a rapidly growing industry. I'm talking billions of dollars, where all you got to do to siphon off a small portion of that is to have some kind of slightly better mousetrap, whether it be media, software, or data, or what have you. And so, yes, you ended up with this bizarre concoction, this fragmented ecosystem of thousands of companies that took advantage of that available venture capital, and they all have a stake in the game. Well, obviously, that's too much, and we do need to sort of enter maturity and rationalization consolidation. Well, it turns out if you look at the numbers, and like whether you're studying a virus or you're studying an industry, look at the numbers, right? And the numbers show you that we reached peak venture capital, that is to say input of money into this industry, reached a peak in 2014. Mm. It reached a peak in terms of exits, number of exits, in 2015. So since 2015, for 5 years, this industry has been in a position of net consolidation. Fewer companies being started, more getting taken out or getting exited. And it actually follows that arc almost like perfectly. It's sort of like scary how much it maps to a natural arc. And so, yes, for the health and for the good of the industry and the players in it, it is appropriate that we go through this era yeah. of rationalization and consolidation. It's yeah. just that it's messy, very messy, when you start with thousands of companies. So what will transpire here is, whilst it's good for the industry, and we've been calling for the need for consolidation, not the fact that we happen to benefit from intermediating those transactions, but the reality is, I think the objective reality is, the industry needed it. And listen, let's think about what happens. The consequence of consolidation means we have fewer players with greater scale that can have a much, much lower take rate and be super profitable. Yeah. Sounds healthy to me. It's just that for the individual entrepreneurs and venture investors, don't worry about the VCs. They're diversified in terms of their portfolio. Yeah, yeah. So shed no tears to the institutional shareholders.
People will be impacted, which is the hard part.
Entrepreneurs. And so we're going yep. through that now. There's and that happens in two ways, right? Outright company failure, capitulation deals. Those two will comprise, sadly, 95% of all exits.
Yeah.
5%. If you look at the last 10 years, 5% of the exits are the ones you hear about and read about
yep.
and people brag about, which are yep. exits that achieve meaningful investor returns for the cap table and build wealth for the entrepreneurs. 5%. I know it's sort of not cool to talk about the realities of that, but 95% are learning experiences and loss making for the institutional investors.
Well, I always like to say that in venture capital, it's like baseball. A 300 hitter makes the Hall of Fame. You know,
absolutely.
So if three out of 10 work, you know, and Chris, that's your business now. Hey, Terry, I want to just change. I want to talk about two topics. I think as people hear your story, it seems like, you know, you're driven, you've had a tremendous amount of success, you know, you have, you know, vision, it seems like you have fun doing it, but, you know, I'm sure over 10 years, so since Luma is turning 10 later this year, I'm sure it wasn't all amazing. I'm sure there are times. So talk to us about maybe, you know, the fact that, I gotta assume in your business, and because you are just a handful of people and you are the founder, you know, you may go months with no income. You're producing a ton of content, you're putting out Luma Skates, you're doing comedy, you're speaking at conferences, but you don't get paid unless a deal happens. I gotta imagine there are months where deals don't happen. Talk to us about kind of cash flow and also talk to us just about, you know, maybe some of the hard times you had over the last 10 years.
Yeah, no, listen, you've seen those diagrams, right, where it says you start here and success is here and it's not a straight line. That's the perception. The reality is the line goes all over the place to get there. And that's always the case. So I guess a couple things. One was the principles that I had at the formation of this firm were a number of them. One was the notion of real partnership. So I don't own the whole company myself. I have, there's five partners at Luma, and because I believe in giving people upside, including the office manager, my assistant who joined me while I was in my pajamas, right, from day one. She got a meaningful stake in the company, and that's materially changed her life, because I believe in this notion of a partnership team approach. That's
Terry,
number one.
Susan, it's hard to interrupt you, but adore her, love her, have seen how you've treated her and as a partner. And I think people, if you haven't met Susan, meet Susan. Sorry, carry on.
And by the way, Susan and I have been singing Les Miserables to each other for decades. So then when you came out with those Les Mis parodies, I was like, that's Susan's influence here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She is. She is a force in nature, and that was one of the best decisions I ever made. And secondly is, look, this is a professional services firm, so I don't believe in the notion of outside capital. So we provided our own capital to support the business, because it just doesn't make any sense to have a services business and outside capital, besides we wanted to maintain, you know, control of our destiny. And so, you do get dry spells and I suppose the third principle, and it probably had an impact in terms of how I scaled or, you know, managed the scale of our business. You know, I believe in having a low fixed nut, keeping as much operating leverage in the business whilst also being able to sleep at night. And so I'm able to do that because we are not doing kind of our P&L doesn't, and our operating leverage doesn't look like the typical investment bank, because they run a lot of processes and that requires a lot of junior people. Yeah. And that's a big fixed nut, et cetera. We are not running processes. We're doing something more akin to strategic matchmaking. So when I talk about the, you know, 95% of the deals being sort of capitulation or auctions for whatever you can get, we're not even in that business. The only business we're interested in is the 5%. And that fundamentally changes the investment infrastructure associated with our business, which lowers our fixed nut, which means we're able to go 6 months. We went 9 months of a dry spell, and then boom, we're a very lumpy business. And then started making, you know, big fees. So and you don't know it's gonna necessarily be there. So you kind of got us. So I guess that means set up your cap table, set up your financing so that you can weather that storm. And then secondly is have an attitude of taking the long view. And you got to do that with some clients. You know, I've had some clients where you add a ton of value. And then at the 11th hour, they allowed their VC to come in and pick the investment bank that they wanted because it was some other IOU not associated with the company, and so you get screwed. And I've been screwed a number of times.
Yeah.
And, you know, I decided there was two ways I could react to that. One was, you know, vengeance and anger and get pissed off at that entrepreneur, but it probably wasn't their fault. And so the other one was to ignore it, persist at it. And I had numerous cases where a CEO whose board was able to bring in a different advisor and I kind of got screwed. Down the road, they remembered that. I continue to maintain the relationship, and it pays off a big time down the road. So what I've learned is when you, and that's another consequence of having, you know, you're starting your own business, is you can take the long view as opposed to take the short view. And so many bankers just sort of go for that, you know, short-term maximization, which is always a loser.
Well, Terry, if things don't work out on the you know, when things go slow and you have a 9-month hiatus, there's always stand up. I don't know how that pays the Fifth Avenue rent. I had one final sort of question and comment, but it comes with a story. So when you and I, everyone always has their moment when they kind of break the ice and really get to know someone. I believe Bill and I, that was in Bill's office when we kind of talked a lot of things personally, including a divorce. And we kind of, I just remember that being a moment where we connected. I remember you and I connecting on a paddleboard expedition out in the Hamptons in Waynescott, where we went. So Bill, we go, you know, about an hour through Santaponic Pond to the beach. We have a swim, we come back, and we talked. At that period, I was going through a very difficult patch in regards to my company and pivoting and trying to sell. I had all these questions.
Yep.
And where I'm going with this is, it's kind of a question, but it's also a comment, which is the question, which I want you to answer in a minute, is what's the biggest misconception of Terry? Terry's loud, Terry's out there, Terry's Terry. And the ones that know you know this authentic, very real person. You're always the first person that I think reaches out to people when they're going through a struggle. I can mention people's names, I'm not gonna do that. But there's this very soft side, sincere human side, which I know, and I saw that on that paddle journey with you. So at the end of that, I think you and I over a couple Coronas, and that's what we were drinking, that was kind of a tipping point for us. And that's when I saw another side of investment banker and boisterous loud Terry. So my point, bringing this all together, is what do you think is the, when you don't know Terry outside of the Luma and the parody videos, what is the misconception that people don't know about you? But they just happen to kind of see you in their feed.
Well, I probably that 95% of the things I do every day do not accrue to Luma's benefit, in the sense that, you know, I'm a big believer in this notion of giving, either whether it's giving to the industry in terms of, you know, like, you know, people have told us, I've had so much feedback saying, you could sell these reports, you could monetize it this way and that way. And I'm like, nah, no thanks. Even advertising on the parody video is like, no thanks. I don't want any of that. I want to stay objective. You know, the single best compliment someone can say about me is objectively credible, in the sense that I don't want to be a shill like those other bankers. And I also am a big believer of, look, you know, I feel like there's a little bit of a cognitive dissonance here where yes, I just described an industry that's bloated and needs significant consolidation. I also said 95% of these companies are going to basically be flushed. Well, that doesn't, and yes, and I have a business, fortunately, that addresses the five, but that doesn't make me feel good, right? I mean, I have friends amongst the 100%. And so, well, okay, fine, maybe not the bottom 20, but the point is, there's a lot of people out there that I want to serve and help, and I'm not going to be able to help them with my day job. That's reserved for the five. So are there things I can do? And yeah, there's a ton of things we can do. We sort of take it upon ourselves to be helpful educators. And one of the things that I've noticed in this industry, which is highly complex, and everyone's kind of, there's a lot of pay to play, right?
Yeah.
Is that by being unfiltered, right? I don't have a boss and I don't have a filter. I can say things that others can't. And what I have found is, you know, if you're selling media or you're buying ads, right, you are kind of constrained in what you can say about either players or trends in the ecosystem because it doesn't serve your interest. I know I'm not constrained by that in any way, shape, or form. And I'll just like tell it like it is. I want the closest approximation to the truth. And it turns out that has tremendous value. when the ANA says, hey, come in and talk to our marketers. And I'm like, I got nothing to do with it. I got nothing to sell to a marketer. And I'll stand up on stage and
say, really good.
I have nothing to sell you.
Yeah.
So let me tell you what I think is going on. And bam, with no filter, and they're like, whoa, holy shit. And the most common response I get was, that's what everyone was thinking in the room.
Yeah.
But no one was able to say it. So thank you for standing up and saying those things. And I think that is I hope that is a benefit and a value to the ecosystem. It's something we can add back.
Absolutely. One of the other things I want to get in here, because we've spoken about it many times, is the comedy. So do you remember what your first parody video was and what made you at the time think of it?
Sure. It was, well, in the sort of latest incarnation, I've been doing comedy for 50 years. So there's been lots of different things, but in terms of taking a song and changing the lyrics,
yes.
It was in the end, it was December of 2007. And I just got a Mac for the first time. I was a PC guy for a long time, just got a Mac, and Christmas break. And I'm discovering iMovie, right? I'm discovering all these new tools where I get to, it was fundamentally different than a PC, right? I got to sort of experiment with all these things. And at the time, as you may recall, we had just gone through really a tormenting year. The first half of 2007 was a gangbuster year for M&A, and the back half was a total disaster where the country was heading towards financial disaster. And of course, that got worse the next year. So I said, wow, what a year. I'm like, it's almost like, you know, you could make a parody out of that. And I did. I wrote a parody song to a Billy Joel song, We Didn't Start the Fire. And that was Wall Street Meltdown.
That
I put out in early 2008. And then, of course, I had to do it again, Wall Street Meltdown Redux, because the next year it was even more crazy. Low quality graphics on those early days. But then in 2009, when it seemed like things were continuing to be horrific, I decided to do one for the media industry, the industry that I served in advertising, and I wrote Mad Avenue Blues, sung to American Pie.
Yeah.
And I did it all in a day, and it really, truly did reflect sort of what was going on, right? Media is in it. In fact, I will stand by, you know, it's what, we're 11 years since I wrote that parody. You know, 250,000 people have watched it or something like that. That stands up today.
Yeah.
11 years later. So.
Yeah. No. Listen. So for those of you who have never seen one of these parody videos, I suggest you go to lumapartners.com. Click on, I don't know, content or videos.
Content.
First, go to superpowerspodcast.com. Go to Luma. Hey, Terry, we have to. We're gonna wrap this up. Bill and I always struggle with this, these conversations, because
The verdict, you gotta come up with the verdict now.
Have to come up with the verdict, yeah.
I'm gonna let my esteemed partner and co-host Bill kick this off as we've kind of gone through this journey, and we try to wrap up your unique superpower.
So I've known Terry a long time. I heard some stories today that I never heard before. I love talking about the young Canadian Alex P. Keaton, you know, him doing the Seinfeld episode of taking the 5 cents and going to Wisconsin. He just happened to know about it, that Canada was changing their rules. I love hearing these stories. And it's funny because now I'm picturing you as like a 13-year-old, you know, in like a little tie. But here's the thing. Here's actually what I have long thought about Terry, which is Terry is an entertainer. He loves to entertain. He loves to bring smiles to people's faces. When he does something, he goes all in. And so I also think that if he didn't live in Manhattan have this luxury lifestyle that he lives, I'm joking. He would likely try to do that full time. The problem is for you know, 99.99% of comedians, comedy normally doesn't pay the bills. So I did a little research while he was talking just now. And I'm going to, you know, just do in raw numbers. And I know he has five partners at Luma, but if you think about, you know, just on an average year, maybe you do six deals. And you know, obviously sometimes you do 10, 12 deals, 15 deals. Sometimes you do maybe a couple less, but if you say you do six or seven deals a year, and on average, those fees are $3 or $4 million per pop, you know, you get to be around, you know, $18-24 million. Now, if you look at that, I'm on Forbes' list of comedians' compensation for 2019, and I'm going to read here. Amy Schumer, $21 million. Sebastian Maniscalco, who I love, $26 million, right? So basically, what you're talking about is, you know, Terry has found a way to channel his comedy, which rivals some of the best, which rivals Amy Schumer. He might actually make more money in comedy than Amy Schumer does.
I'm aiming for Jerry Seinfeld.
You know, and so it's interesting. Trevor Noah, $28 million. I think you can probably catch him. He's number four on the list. Jerry Seinfeld last year was number two on the list at $41 million. Kevin Hart, $59 million. Gonna be hard for you to catch Kevin Hart, but and Jerry Seinfeld, but. You should be thinking about Trevor Noah as like the next on the hit list. I am going to say that Terry is the fifth most highly compensated comedian in the world, just behind Trevor Noah, and that's his superpower. And his superpower is he found out that through investment banking he can become the number five comedian. And there you go. And there you go.
So I'm gonna, Bill. That was probably one of your most creative and thoughtful conclusions on these shows. So thanks for that.
Yeah.
So outside of some of the obvious pillars of social awareness, a high degree of energy, a couple of things that also come to mind in regards to Terry's superpower. I think the storytelling.
First of all, this is like I have to say this to my mother now. I mean.
Yeah, of course you do. Of course, so you.
I'm three last comments, and we're closing out, Terry. And this is you can go pop some bottles, and who knows if we're ever this nice again.
Exactly.
I think the straight talk piece that you shared a moment ago, it's something I've always understood, but I actually think that value for so many people is a superpower. I think the truth does set us free. I think very few people can speak the truth. I think that is a superpower. But if I had to just nail it and conclude it. You're an amazing storyteller, and everything that you can storytelling today, if you look at the best brands and marketers or entertainers, you talk about and hear stories as the kind of the core component. I think you have a very unique ability to tell a story, and it doesn't matter how good someone's idea is or where they want to go, but if you can't sort of illustrate it, whether it's through a video or through a graphic or a logo, it doesn't fucking matter. You're not going to be able to get people to consume. So I think you're an amazing storyteller as your superpower, and I hope that you reach the milestones, the riches that Bill outlined, both from maybe the ego perspective, but also you get a bigger house out east and we can go party there. So with that, Terry Khawaja, on behalf of Bill and I and our viewers and Superpowers podcast, we loved having you, and thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right, stay safe. Best to your wife and kids.
Superpowers.